Well met, and welcome to episode 45, the Bill Shakespeare Project podcast for May the 16th, 2010. For our blog and previous podcast episodes, check us out at thebillshakespeareproject.com. Greetings. This is Bill Walthall, and this week we're going to continue our month-long discussion of Romeo and Juliet. We'll begin our discussion of reviews of productions available on DVD, including what may be the worst production I've seen on DVD, remind you about an upcoming Bill Shakespeare Project video conference, and then do our recap of this week's blog entries. Now, with a play as popular as Romeo and Juliet, you know there's a boatload of versions, even more than last month's Midsummer. Okay, so if you're a longtime listener, you know that I always like to kick off the DVD discussion with the BBC Complete Works series productions because they tend to be a good touchstone for comparison, as they are typically full-text versions done without too much high concept. So that being said, let's start off with the 1978 BBC production directed by Alvin Rakoff. Taped in early 78, it was the first of the plays in the canon to be produced and aired. Produced on a television soundstage in period costumes, it is a straightforward production with a cast that includes John Gielgud as the chorus, Michael Horndon as Capulet, he'll play Lear and Prospero in The Tempest later in the series, and get this, Alan Rickman, yes, Bruce Willis's nemesis from the first Die Hard film.
Do you really think you have a chance against us, Mr. Cowboy?
And Severus Snape in the Harry Potter movies in his first television acting gig as Tybalt. Now, despite having an all-time great voice, Gielgud is pretty much wasted in his 28-line role. In many stage productions, the chorus is double-cast with the prince. It would have been great to see that here, just to see him on screen more. Now, Horndon does a great job with Capulet, especially in the party sequence with Tybalt, using his disjointed lines to show perfectly how he's trying to disguise his chastisement of his nephew to the rest of the party guests, and his torturous railings against Juliet when she refuses to marry Paris. Rickman, in a really bad pageboy haircut and almost harlequinesque two-tone tights, could have made for an almost comical Tybalt, but his now trademark sneer and snarl is in evidence even in this early role, and his line readings make for a truly dangerous, if not flashy, villain. Rakoff opens the play with a Samson with a black eye, and a brawl that does not feel urgent until the brawlers knock down and bloody a small child. No wonder the citizens end up chanting, "Down with the Capulets, down with the Montagues." When we meet the Capulets in that first scene, their age difference is obvious and stunning. Now, since I think this is a big subtextual motivation in the play, I loved this. What I loved less was the really old prince. I would have thought that his age would garner a little more respect, but it really doesn't. Patrick Ryecart as Romeo displays in those early scenes a kind of tired restlessness that I suppose is his idea of depression. It works to a large extent, and when he finally meets Juliet, he does seem to come alive. Rebecca Sayre, as Juliet, is wonderful. Sayre was only 14 when she performed the role. Perfect age, and a great performance. The age difference between her and Rakoff, obviously in his mid-20s, was nicely done as well. To have both he and Paris and Tybalt be closer to the age of Lady Capulet makes for a very interesting dynamic. Rakoff makes some really nice directorial decisions. The Queen Mab speech is atypical, as it seems that Anthony Andrews' character is recounting an earlier speech that he's heard somewhere before. Many well-done interpretations have Mercutio inventing the speech as he goes, and most bad ones are simply speeches memorized by the actor playing Mercutio. This, however, with his searching his memory rather than his imagination for words, makes for a more playful scene. Playful, too, is Mercutio's duel with Tybalt, as Mercutio takes every advantage to poke fun at Tybalt, lightening the fight, but deepening the tragedy when he's killed. Rakoff also sets the prince's post-brawl, post-killing speech to take place obviously some hours after the brawl, and this gives the scene more deliberative weight as opposed to a sudden rash decision spurred on by current events. Now, I'm not sure I like it, but it's certainly made for an interesting staging, as did the later forcing of the Capulets and Montagues to leave the graveyard and actually venture forth down into the tomb to see their slain children. Seeing each other and their respective sorrows in the tomb, it's understandable why and how they would bury their strife there. But the best scene in the production is Juliet's scene with Celia Johnson's nurse, when the nurse returns with what Juliet hopes is news of their impending marriage. Johnson's nurse is a wry one, toying with the girl, and Juliet's growing frustration is fun to watch. I would have liked a little more lasciviousness and thus a little more lusty comedy to the nurse's bawdiness. Here it seems almost innocent or quaint, but this scene is still the high watermark for the production. All in all, a very good production. Not great, but a solid starting point. Next up is the MGM production from 1936, directed by George Cukor from an adaptation by Talbot Jennings. Cukor was a Hollywood heavyweight, a legend, having directed both Little Women and David Copperfield before this film, and Gone with the Wind, The Philadelphia Story, Born Yesterday, and A Star is Born after. Now, with MGM behind it, the film boasted an all-star cast. Norma Shearer as Juliet, Leslie Howard as Romeo, John Barrymore as Mercutio, and Basil Rathbone as Tybalt. The film does a good job of introducing the play, putting each actor on screen with their role and their affiliation or position, and then beginning with a parade through town that delineates the sides and their hatred for one another. The opening brawl is more of a skirmish, with dozens of combatants and fighters actually dying. The Benvolio-Tybalt fight here is especially hardcore, with Basil Rathbone, Errol Flynn's nemesis in The Adventures of Robin Hood, as Tybalt. Now, even at a hair over 2 hours, there's quite a bit of cutting and rearranging of the text. No mention is made of Juliet's age, which makes sense since Shearer was 34 when she made the film. Of course, Howard was also a 43-year-old Romeo. There is no request by the Montagues for Benvolio to discover the root of Romeo's depression. In fact, the film moves from the opening brawl to Paris's proposal to Lady Capulet's discussion of it to Juliet, and then to meeting Romeo. Yeah, we meet Juliet before we meet Romeo. Now, none of those cuts kill the play, but it is interesting. Interesting, too, is the rearrangement of Act Two. After the balcony scene, we go to Benvolio and Mercutio on the street, and then Romeo and the nurse. Only after their meeting does Romeo go to Friar Lawrence, so that his initial discussion with the friar is interrupted by Juliet's entrance for the wedding. Now, this one's a little more problematical, but it doesn't kill the picture either. Now, there is no scene with Paris and Capulet renegotiating the marriage on the night of Tybalt's death, so we just move immediately to Lady Capulet announcing that the marriage is tomorrow. In other words, we miss the whole acceleration of the wedding from Thursday to Wednesday. Now this, I think, really does hurt the film, as we get no feeling of the events spiraling out of control. And worse than that is the fact that Lady Montague is alive and well at the end of the play, standing by the side of her husband. Doing this kills the symmetry of death in the play, but more on that later. Now, though these are problematic, Cukor also makes some truly great directorial choices. When Romeo and his friends are going to the party, and he calls for a torch, it's so that he can go back home. That's nice. In the balcony scene, Romeo sees Juliet's empty window and says, "Soft, what light through yonder window breaks?" And then she comes into the window, and it's only then that he says, "It is the east, and Juliet is the sun." Now that's really nice. Later, we actually see the pestilence and Friar John being quarantined. Unnecessary, but it was different. Cukor directs Edna May Oliver as a comically bawdy nurse to Juliet. Well, at least as bawdy as you could get for 1936. It's wonderful. He also combines the characters of Samson and Peter, so we get a hot-headed Peter and a not-so-quite-bright Samson. That was brilliant. Not quite so brilliant was Barrymore's turn as Mercutio. I wasn't sure if he was supposed to be a fop, gay, or just mercilessly chewing scenery as an actor. It just didn't work for me. Like I said, that didn't work for me, but it was nothing on the level of unemployment that Shearer's Juliet was for me. Number one, she's just too old, nearly three times the age she's supposed to be. She's introduced into the ball with a song by a choir. Shearer was incredibly overwrought in both the balcony scene and her about to take the fake death potion scene. Even in her scenes with the nurse, she's just too mature. So why did Cukor cast her in the movie? Beyond the fact that she was a great actress spanning the silent and talkie eras with multiple Oscar nominations, including one for this film. Oh, yeah. She was the wife of MGM producer Irving Thalberg. Well, okay then. Ironically enough, Thalberg died on the night of this film's premiere. Okay, so I'm not a big fan of this film, but I do think it's worth watching, if for no other reasons that, one, you get to see the acting style of the day. Yeah, I'm still harping on that whole Shearer thing. And two, you get to see what Hollywood does to Shakespeare. And it's no different between the 30s and today, sadly. Okay, the next one is a 1965 television production from RADA, the Royal Academy of Dramatic Arts in London, a drama school that has had alumni including Peter O'Toole, Ralph Fiennes, and Kenneth Branagh, none of whom appear in this, sadly. Then again, none of them could have saved this either, so maybe that's a good thing. The telecast was directed by Val Drum and Paul Lee, based on a staging at RADA by Hugh Morrison. It felt like the play was shot on the stage itself without an audience, but with actors still projecting to the rafters, overacting to the camera. And those camera shots were all static, with non-moving cameras and very few zooms or pans. Now, like the BBC Age of Kings productions that we discussed during the histories late last year, the black and white look, the texture, is much akin to the old Twilight Zone telecasts, complete, in this case, with overpowering but underwhelming music by Richard Hewson. Now, running at 1 hour and 3/4, maybe that's 2 hours traffic with commercials, the play was heavily edited. And unlike the 1936 version's cuts and rearrangements, these hacks do hurt the production. What's missing? Well, we start with Part Fools from Benvolio. The nurse's meeting with Romeo in Act 2, Scene 4? Gone. The Benvolio Mercutio intro into the fight in Act 3, Scene 1? Gone. The nurse delivering the news of Tybalt's death and Romeo's banishment to Juliet? Gone-a-rooney. And then there was the weird and inconsistent use of voiceover for soliloquies. There was no excitement in the Mercutio and Tybalt fight, and only a little in Romeo and Tybalt's. Now, while the leads, Clive Francis as Romeo and Angela Scolar as Juliet, are reasonably attractive, there's really no spark, not between them or in and of themselves at all. As performed by Hayward Morris, Mercutio's Queen Mab's speech is just that, a speech. There's no sense of discovery, invention, or even recollection as there was in the 78 BBC version. Quite frankly, the acting here made the 1936 version look naturalistic in comparison. And in comparison, you might understand why Norma Shearer was awarded an Academy Award nomination. Do you get the feeling that I hated this production? Yeah. It was laughable. There are better and more dramatic pieces to be found on YouTube as produced by high school freshman students for their class projects. Actual high school productions of the play are better than this. How bad is this? Here's a classic moment. Romeo takes the poison and dies on top of Juliet. When the friar arrives and Juliet awakes, they have a conversation with Romeo lying across her body. And then she asks where Romeo is, like she couldn't feel him. And the friar says, "Thy husband in thy bosom there lies dead." Now guys, this is a metaphor. Romeo doesn't have to actually be lying on her chest, especially when she later has trouble sitting up because of Romeo's weight on her. I mean, it was just laughably bad. You know how there's good, and then there's bad, and then there's so bad that it's good? Well, this goes beyond to so bad that it's not even really fun to ridicule. I cannot think of a Shakespeare DVD I have hated as much as this one. Avoid this one like the freaking plague. Now, we'll see if next week's productions are better. And I know definitely one of them is. Now, last podcast, I mentioned that this is one of my favorite plays, and in the blogs, I go into deeper detail, but here's just one reason, and one I've mentioned before in my discussion of the 1936 version. At the beginning of the play, we're told that there are two households, both alike in dignity. Yep, the Capulets and the Montagues are alike in worthiness, nobleness, excellence, but there are actually three families. We need to remember the family of the prince. A prince with a name in the cast of characters, but never uttered on stage, of Aeschylus. A homonym, perhaps, to the father of Greek tragedy? Maybe. Well, Prince Aeschylus has two kinsmen in the play. As the prince says near the end of the play, all are punished. Now, how true this is. The Capulets lose Juliet and Tybalt. The Montagues lose Romeo and Lady Montague. Montague tells the prince, "Alas, my liege, my wife is dead tonight. Grief of my son's exile hath stopped her breath." And the prince loses his kinsmen, Mercutio and Paris. And as if just to make sure people don't miss it, in stating his own culpability in the tragic events, the prince says, "And I, for winking at your discords too, have lost a brace of kinsmen." And here brace means a pair or a couple. Yes, all are punished. Each of the three families loses two members. Now, it's interesting that in the bad quarto of 1597, Montague also announces the death of Benvolio. But for subsequent printings, that death is removed. Could it be that having Benvolio die would ruin the symmetry of death in Romeo and Juliet? And that's why Shakespeare removed it? Could be. And, by the way, two quick notes about Benvolio. First, he's a character with just about the most perfect name. Benvolio means goodwill. And his first action is an attempt to stop the brawl in the opening scene with the statement, "Part fools, put up your swords, you know not what you do," which, you know, is a Christ reference. Second, the last we see or hear Benvolio is his description of the Mercutio-Tybalt-Romeo sword fights to the prince in Act 3, Scene 1. He vanishes from the play, never mentioned except in that bad quarto, again. Goodwill and any chance for a happy ending disappears, and we are left with a death spiral for the remainder of the play. Now, I directed the play back in the 90s, and the intermission took place just after Prince announces Romeo's banishment. We worked on a stage without a curtain, and so during intermission, I had the nurse cleaning up the bloody mess that was Tybalt and Benvolio leaving town. Neither character is the same after that point. Yeah, I really like this play. Just a reminder, tomorrow night, Monday, May 17th, at 7 p.m. Pacific time, we're going to have our second video conference. Now, this month, we're discussing the star-crossed lovers on the blog, and we know what a perennial high school freshman lit favorite that is, and usually during this time of year. So let's let any schoolers you know about this chance to talk about the play, and join us yourselves as well. So remember, Monday, May 17th, 7 p.m. Pacific, that's 10 p.m. for you Wright Coasters, we're going to get together online. If you've got a microphone and a webcam, we'll get to hear and see you. If not, well, at least you can hear and see us. There will be a text-only component so everyone can participate, but I'm really looking forward to meeting as many of you as possible face to disembodied face. So tomorrow, go to www.billwalthall.com/BSPconf. Now, I'll post the URL on this blog entry, plus one tomorrow, as well as on our Facebook page. Then, on Monday's posts, I'll also announce this week's passcode for entry into the room. I'd like to keep the conversation Romeo and Juliet-centric, but you know me, I'm easy. Now, if you've enjoyed this podcast, but you haven't been following along with our daily blog entries this week, you've missed out on subjects including Sources, The Genealogy of Romeo and Juliet, Death in Symmetry, Prologue in Sonnet Form, Love at First Sight in Sonnet Form, Foreshadowing of a Love Cut Short, Sonnet Interruptus, and Paging Benvolio. So, if you'd like more in-depth discussions or just want a daily fix, check out the blog entries at thebillshakespeareproject.com, or become a fan of our Facebook page. Now remember that the Facebook page is more for Shakespeare news and notes than the daily discussions of our play of the month. Also, if you have any questions or comments about this or any other Bill Shakespeare Project podcast or blog entry, you can always lob me an email at bill@thebillshakespeareproject.com. And of course, please join us again for our next podcast. We hope to see you then. You've been listening to the Bill Shakespeare Project podcast for May the 16th, 2010. For our blog and previous podcast episodes, check us out at thebillshakespeareproject.com, and we shall see thee anon.